This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
President Trump sits down with Russian strongman Vladimir Putin in Helsinki, and in Britain, calls for a second Brexit. Welcome to Foreign Edition. I'm Mary Kissel with the Wall Street Journal editorial board, coming to you from New York City. And I'm very pleased to welcome my friend and colleague, political economics columnist, Joseph Sternberg, who's calling in from London. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Mary.
So you and I have just sat through the Trump-Putin press conference. And Joe, I'm a little stunned, although maybe I shouldn't be, at the conciliatory language that was used in this press conference to describe Putin. President Trump saying that it was a deeply productive open dialogue, saying we have to find ways to cooperate with Putin. On his part, Vladimir Putin saying that it was a businesslike conversation, but the Cold War is past. We have to move on. We need to cooperate. Lots of overlapping and mutual interests. That was the language that he used. Joe, I guess this could have been worse. There really wasn't anything concretely agreed here. But lost in all of this is the fact that Putin is the reason for all of the problems that were described in the press conference, from Syria to the INF treaty to cyber. Joe, I'm just kind of at a loss here. What was your take?
Well, I'm stunned but not surprised, because, I mean, what exactly was going to come out of a summit like this, given the behavior pattern, particularly of Putin, you know, not just most recently, but over the long stretch of his rule in Russia? I mean, clearly you were going to go into the summit where Trump was not going to be sitting across the table from a reliable negotiating partner by any stretch of the imagination. And then to come out and give this extraordinary press conference that, for example, suggests that U.S. and Russia are somehow equally to blame for the deterioration in the relationship between the two in recent years. These long, meandering responses that seemed intended to deflect attention from any questions about what Russia's role in the 2016 election might have been, allowing Putin unchallenged to suggest that somehow the Mueller investigation should allow the Russian authorities to interrogate some of the Russian individuals who have just been indicted by the special counsel's office. I mean, it is an astonishing performance from a U.S. president. And I think that really we have to ask ourselves, if this is what winning looks like, what would losing look like?
Yeah, well, I have to say, Joe, it was a classic example of Vladimir Putin-style manipulation. He starts by flattering President Trump, which we know that Trump likes, praising, for instance, his personal engagement with North Korea, and then proceeds to construct this kind of parallel universe where there are these conflicts that have magically appeared that Russia has nothing to do with, but that Russia would like to solve. And we've seen Putin do this before. We saw him do it to President Obama, offering, for instance, to help solve Syria and then coming in and essentially propping up Assad and helping Assad commit war crimes. Putin did it again to Trump last year when he said, I'll help you in Syria. And instead, gave Assad help subjugating other parts of the country before turning to the area where he promised he would de-escalate with us. This is what I had come to expect from Putin. So I don't think there's any surprise there. I just think that, you know, looking at that fact pattern, the surprise is to see a U.S. president have any kind of hope that there could be cooperation. Where is the evidence that we can cooperate with somebody like this?
Precisely. And I think that, you know, one of the things I'm already noticing is that some people who might be inclined to defend Trump on this issue have been taking to Twitter and other social media to point out that, you know, previous presidents, both George W. Bush and Barack Obama, had, you know, problematic relationships with Putin and Russia, you know, where in various ways they would have allowed Russia to get the upper hand. And, you know, in various forms in that relationship. And that is true. But I think that it's also can be the case that what Trump has just done is worse, because you go out and you grace Putin with a press conference where you aren't even expecting some sort of pretense cooperation from Putin. I mean, you do this, you know, joint appearance on the stage with the flags but waving behind them. You know, that is intended to legitimize all of the fluff and distraction that Putin uses to try to pull people's attention away from all of the problematic behavior that he engages in.
And you know it's bad, Joe. You know it's bad when Putin is suggesting that Ukraine is our fault and somehow the Trump administration should be the one to, as Putin put it, nudge the Ukrainian leadership into resolving the conflict in Crimea and in eastern Ukraine, where thousands of Ukrainians have died of fighting the foreign occupation of, you know, Putin's little green men. You know, that shows you, I mean, to me, that's a real tell, because it shows that Putin thinks he has the upper hand in these discussions. Also, the suggestion that maybe, you know, Russia could send people over to the United States to help them investigate the cyber hacking of the DNC. I mean, what arrogance from the Russian leader to make those kinds of statements on the world stage. And I think it means that he's taken the measure of President Trump and he thinks he has the upper hand.
Quite. And I think that, you know, it is important to really bear down on this issue of this whole moral equivalence malarkey that Trump was, you know, bringing up at various points during this press conference, suggesting that America and Russia are equally responsible for the deterioration in relations, allowing Putin to go unchallenged in, you know, some of the issues that you just mentioned involving you know, parts of Ukraine, such as Crimea. And Russia's illegal annexation there. Because the reality is that Russia and the U.S. are not equal powers.
No.
Russia is the weaker entity here. I think that economically, you know, Putin faces significant problems at home. The political economy in Russia is a lot weaker. Putin's hold on power is perhaps weaker than people tend to realize. And I think that is why something like this has such serious and damaging consequences, because Trump is basically reinforcing this notion that somehow we ought to be taking Putin so seriously, when I think that actually a you know, better approach to the Russian problem would have been to recognize that there are various weaknesses and pressure points within Russia, within Putin's regime, and to try to push on those very subtly. And so, I mean, if you wanted to do a press conference where you would really bore down and perhaps make some borderline embarrassing statements, you know, standing next to Putin about what he's doing in Ukraine, that would be one thing. But I think such a fawning, you know, appearance that is intended to indulge Putin's, you know, attempts to create this impression that he is still a great world power in the way that the Soviet Union used to be a world power, I think that is very damaging.
Well, he certainly portrayed Putin as a power in the Middle East, given the kind of language that he used, Joe, and he certainly legitimized Putin, which is very important, of course, to the illegitimate Russian leader, because let's recall he's not democratically elected and his political opponents have either been killed or jailed or exiled abroad. So, you know, legitimacy is important here for Putin because that's what he wants, not just to boost his domestic popularity, but he'd like to be accepted back into organizations like the G7, which he was rightly kicked out of after the invasion of Ukraine. Joe, I thought that the language on Syria was particularly notable because Trump talked about it in humanitarian terms, that he wants to help stop the killing, whereas Putin talked about Syria in terms of cold, hard strategic interests. And, I mean, that's the whole story of Syria, right? That, you know, we say we want to help people, and yet all we do is allow Russia and Iran and Assad to change the facts on the ground. In many ways, a naive approach out of the U.S. president.
Yeah, it's hard to see how any of this is going to help the situation there, because, as you said, the problem all along has been that successive U.S. administrations, both the Obama administration and then Trump, who does have to, after a year and a half, take some responsibility for these various messes around the world, have allowed untrustworthy or outright bad actors such as Putin or Bashar Assad to create facts on the ground that the U.S. then needs to work around. And I think that certainly this is a classic example of where I think that Putin has taken a very accurate measure of Trump and his attention span and what he is politically willing to do in terms of Syria policy within Washington, and is exploiting that. And so I think that it's just part and parcel of this broader issue where you have to look at a summit like this and think, what have we actually accomplished here if all you were doing is giving the seal of an event of this sort to those attempts to create facts on the ground that are not to America's advantage.
You know, Joe, that phrase, what have we accomplished here, that's so important, because the other takeaway, I think, from this press conference is that Trump seems to think that engagement is good for engagement's sake and that there's no cost to it. But I think the argument that you've just outlined explains why that's not true. Why U.S. Legitimacy and U.S. deterrence can suffer when you stand up in front of the world's cameras and you act this way toward a petty autocrat who is, sitting on top of thousands of nukes and, in power because of his security services and the criminal gang of oligarchs that he oversees. Joe, I said on Fox just now, it could have been much worse. And I'm getting a lot of blowback from that because, effectively, that's a pretty low bar. My fear is that he was going to de facto recognize Russia's occupation of Crimea or strike a really bad deal on Syria. I mean, at least he didn't do that, right?
Well, but I just find that kind of argument rather unconvincing. I mean, no disrespect to you for making it. But and I think it is because when you are the U.S. president, you don't have the latitude to just not do the worst thing that you could do. I mean, you have to actually be able to look forward and act in a way that will, move the chess pieces down the board in such a way that you have some chance of winning.
Joe, that is not this president. He doesn't think long term. He thinks in short term deals. I think he's very transactional. Unfortunately, I mean, I wish he thought that way, but I just don't think he does.
No, I mean, I think that's certainly true, but that doesn't necessarily make this outcome any better.
Of course.
I think it you raise such an interesting point here about the fact that it is not cost-free to engage in a discussion like this. So, I mean, I imagine that in Trump's business background, such as it is, he's been in a lot of situations in the New York real estate world where there wasn't necessarily any downside to taking a meeting just to hear the other person out. But you don't have the luxury of doing that when you're the U.S. president. I mean, when you are an American president, the mere fact that a meeting has happened can have significance independent of whatever result comes out of it.
Going to take a quick break. We're talking about the Trump-Putin press conference in Helsinki, and you're listening to Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard, You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Got something to say? Then email your question or comment to podcasts@DowJones.com. Please include your first name and hometown, and we may read your email in a future episode. Again, that's podcasts@DowJones.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition. Mary Kissel in New York, Joe Sternberg in London, and we are having a spirited analysis and dialogue about the Trump-Putin press conference that just ended in Helsinki. Joe, final thoughts.
Well, I think that it's just this problem where there are costs associated with doing something like this. I mean, even if you have a summit that doesn't result in anything, let alone an extraordinary press conference of the sort that we all just had to suffer through, you know, the mere fact that the meeting took place, that Trump graced Putin with his presence, has a certain significance to it. And I think that it is a real problem for America. Foreign policy and our reputation in the world, that we have a president who doesn't seem to understand that, who would go into a meeting of this sort and then come out not only without anything really concrete to show for it, but then also give this extraordinary performance in a press conference where he seems to legitimate, someone who is, an increasingly authoritarian ruler in his own country and often working at odds with American interests.
Well, amen to that. Two thumbs down. I think Putin won this round. Joe, I want to turn quickly to where you're sitting in London. Some turmoil within the Tory party in the wake of President Trump's visit to Britain and several press conferences, particularly the one that President Trump had with Prime Minister Theresa May. Joe, calls emerging now for a second Brexit referendum. How seriously should we take these calls?
Well, I think that, at the moment, it seems unlikely that it's going to happen. But I think that what really has been interesting over the past week since the emergence of the so-called Chequers document or paper where Theresa May claimed that she had secured the agreement of the members of her cabinet for how to go forward with Brexit. I mean, what we've seen is that actually there isn't really very much agreement there at all. And the problem continues to be that Brexit seemingly can mean anything to anyone. And there isn't really a lot of agreement within Theresa May's Conservative Party. So, in fact, one of the people who is now calling for a second referendum on whatever the outcome here should be is actually a Conservative member of Parliament herself, Justine Greening, who used to be a minister in the government. And I think that the backdrop for this and the reason that listeners in the U.S. should be concerned is a growing body of polling suggesting that, if there is another general election, if Theresa May's government comes under threat from this and suffers some sort of accidental collapse and Brits have to go to the polls again, Jeremy Corbyn's far-left Labour Party is looking more and more like the responsible adults in the room here.
Yeah, that is frightening, Joe, given what Corbyn's agenda would be, which is essentially the nationalization of industries, higher taxes, a break in the U.S.-UK special relationship. That is a very frightening prospect, not just to us here at Foreign Edition, but to many, I would argue, on the left side of politics in Britain who don't want to see the Labour Party go to that extreme. There are still, remember, a lot of Blairites out there who want a pro-business, reasonable but compassionate Labour Party. Joe, what is the state of the resignations? We talked a little bit about this last week after Boris Johnson, the former foreign secretary, and David Davis, the minister for Brexit, resigned. Have others followed in their footsteps?
You haven't seen that many high-profile resignations. I think that David Davis and Boris were the two, and then there might have been a few junior people who have left over the past week. I mean, certainly Brexiteers had been hoping that you were going to see a mass exodus, and that hasn't happened. And you've also seen some leading Brexit supporters like the Trade Minister Liam Fox, the Environment Secretary Michael Gove, falling in line behind Theresa May. But, you know, I think that just goes to show the degree of confusion even among the pro-Brexit camp about what they can realistically ask for at this point, what they can get political support for in the country, the electorate as a whole. And so I think that, you know, even at this late date with Brexit really only around the corner next March, what all of this is showing is that there isn't, you know, people in Britain still aren't exactly clear what it is that they voted for in the referendum back in 2016.
Well, I have to say, the one part of President Trump's visit where I thought, you know, his critique was of Prime Minister May was accurate, it was when he said she didn't do what I told her to do. You know, she, in other words, they should have done a hard Brexit or taken a stronger stance, given people what they voted for. Now, obviously, I don't think it was appropriate for him to do that before he visits the country and she hosts him. But Joe, really, the Tories have dug their own hole here, haven't they?
Right. And I think that it's particularly on the part of the Brexit supporters going back even before the 2016 referendum, because, you know, there was never really this big push to explain in practical terms what Brexit was going to mean for the country, or to start building support for a particular version of Brexit. I think that the referendum debate in retrospect was very vague about what the future was going to look like, about what kind of settlement Britain would try to achieve with the EU, even what would be achievable. And so I think that, you know, one lesson I've drawn from this is that it's why referendums are generally not a good idea. I think that it, you know, we would have found that it would have been better if the Parliament had continued looking at these questions and balancing all of these competing interests.
Well, we will leave it at that. That's it for Foreign Edition today. For comments, please tweet to us at Joseph Sternberg and at Mary Kissel, all one word. We read each and every tweet. Again, thanks for listening. We'll be back with you on Wednesday.